I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. War reporter Janine DiGiovanni arrived in Syria in 2012 and has spent the last 4 years talking with Syrians and watching as the Arab Spring has turned into a brutal and bloody civil war. She's reported on the rape, torture, and bombings that have destroyed much of the country. Almost 500,000 people have been killed and millions have left. DiGiovanni writes about the devastation and suffering of civilians who have stayed behind in wartime Syria in her new book, The Morning They Came for Us, including how they survive and how they retain their humanity in the face of degrading violence. She's been reporting on the region for 2 decades and covered the Bosnian Civil War. She's Middle East editor of Newsweek and contributing editor of Vanity Fair, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Janine DiGiovanni, thanks for joining us and thanks for writing this book.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. In fact, you begin this book with a friend who warned you not to go to Syria because he believed it would hurt you emotionally. And he also said he was worried you would not be able to reconcile your anger. So why did you go in defiance of your friend?
Well, I think it was very good advice because I think certainly one thing that has always fueled me and some of my colleagues is that quest to kind of give justice to people that are being violated in many, many ways. And the thing about war zones is that for me, it's never really been about the conventional armies or embedding with soldiers. It's about the people because life goes on while there's war. People have to raise their children. Children get older. They have to go to school. They have to cook for them, even if there's limited food or very little water. Life does carry on. People get sick. People die. People fall in love. And I think this is what I was really trying to do. But increasingly, when you do this kind of reporting, you do get angry because you feel that in the case of Syria or in Bosnia or in Rwanda or other conflicts I've reported, you think, where's the world right now? You know, how can we as human beings allow this to happen to other human beings? Why do we let this on our watch take place? So I think that's what he meant. How could I possibly reconcile the frustration and the anger that I would feel?
You describe coming into Syria. I'm actually going to Damascus. This is June 2012 or May 2012. This is 4 years ago. And you're on a highway. You see a large portrait of President Assad. Then you see a Dunkin' Donuts that apparently serves cheese sandwiches.
Yeah.
And you also describe being at a pool party at your hotel. And inside the hotel, people are dancing and having fun. You look outside the hotel into the surrounding area, and there's a war going on.
Well, I think that just to clarify for listeners, there's two Syrias, really. There's one that is the regime side, which is the Assad side, which is Damascus and parts that are controlled by the regime. And in those areas, they're much less affected. They're not getting pummeled by bombs. I mean, they're in a war. You know, their assets are frozen. They can't. They're afraid of car bombs and things like that. But it's very different from what's happening on the opposition side, those who are opposed to Assad. So in Aleppo, in Idlib, in Deir ez-Zor, in any of the areas which are called the besieged areas, like Yarmouk or Daraya, where people are, you know, they're probably not supporting, they might be supporting the opposition, but really they're just in an opposition area, and therefore they're being brutally punished with bombing, with starvation used as a tool of war. So that first trip to Damascus, I had gotten a visa from the Assad regime. And I drove in, and the war was in its first year, so it was in its infancy. It hadn't really clicked with people that, you know, we are going to descend into chaos. And so they were living as though they ordinarily would. Thursdays are the Muslim weekend, and people were, you know, partying like mad. And women were going to hairdressers. I went to the opera one night. And then I would drive down the road to Homs, which was only an hour and a half away, and it would be utter devastation. So very, I think what I was really trying to do in that section of the book is to point out how you can move from one area to the next and go from an absolute, almost normality to hell.
Well, and you know, we tend to, certainly in this country, if I can speak broadly here, especially looking at a conflict in Syria, not understanding the region, we see Assad supporters on one side and protesters or activists on the other side. Reading your book, I got a much more complicated and nuanced view of the opponents and how, who they are and how they view each other.
Yes. I mean, it would be so much more, it'd be so much easier for all of us, myself included, if we could
Absolutely.
Just draw a line and say, okay, here's the good guys, here's the bad guys, or here's the regime and here's the opponents. But unfortunately, it's morphed into something much more complicated. So you do have on the Assad side, you have people who support Assad because they might be minorities, they might be Jews or Christians or Yazidis or Druze or Shias or basically Kurds who might think, we do not want ISIS to get to Damascus. Or who is the alternative to Assad? So a lot of people who might not in the beginning of the war have supported Assad now feel, or at least people I've spoken to, and I'm not saying this is the majority, but this is just the way some people think. Look, we don't want some radical jihadist sitting in Damascus, so we'll keep him where he is. On the opposition side, you had people who very early on were peaceful demonstrators who wanted to follow the model of, let's say, Tunisia, which did work in some ways in achieving some form of democracy. But then very quickly it morphed into a violent uprising when Assad fired into the crowd and imprisoned children and when these horrific human rights violations began to happen. But then what increasingly happened is that the opposition split, the armed opposition, into many, many, many militias. It's estimated up to 1,000 now. Mm-hmm. And then even more complicated, into al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda faction in Syria, a franchise in Syria, and ISIS, which began their rise in about 2013. So these guys increasingly fight amongst themselves.
Just to add another layer of complication.
So what I always say to people is really don't feel as though you're ignorant, because I have to sit down and draw charts and flow charts and things like that to have it make sense to me.
Well, here's another very simple question. I mean, can you say, based on what you just described there, that Assad created ISIS? I mean, by shooting into the protesters, that created an environment for ISIS to grow?
You know, I try. This is one theory. I've always tried, in the same way that in the Middle East people say that, you know, the United States created Al Qaeda. I try to stay away from things like that. I mean, really, what my job is to go in, to sit on the floor with people, to talk to them, to get their stories, and then to bring it out. I think it would be very arrogant for me to try to tell the story of Syrians. I want them to tell their story. Mm. So, was ISIS encouraged by Assad? Well, I would say ISIS was more encouraged by us, the international community, by ignoring it, and also by the destruction of Iraq. I mean, really, the seeds of this come from, and I'm not someone who blames everything. I live in France, and in France, you know, blame is laid all the time on the Bushes and Tony Blair for destroying Iraq and therefore creating this mayhem. And, you know, I believe that we shouldn't look back right now. There, you know, terrible things happened in Iraq, and it certainly paved the way for what has happened in Damascus. But I think we need to focus now on how to stop the war, how to stop the killing, how to open up humanitarian passages. I mean, that really is my concern and my advocacy right now. Looking back at things we could have done, and there was a lot. You know, this war could have been stopped in 2013. When Obama, you know, when the red line, supposed red line, was crossed, but it wasn't. But we're 3 years on from that now, and there's nearly 300,000 people dead. Mm. And before there's another 300,000, I think that the international community has to work together to end this slow genocide.
Well, let me ask you about some of the people that you talked to, that you met, including a young woman named Nada in the book. She was a protester. You met her at a safe house, and you describe, I have to say, in vivid detail, very difficult to read what she went through. But I think it's important for our listeners to understand what someone like Nada has endured and what that says about the people who tortured and raped her, which, as you described, they certainly did. Tell us about Nada.
Nada is a young activist who grew up in Latakia, which is the Alawite heartland of Syria, meaning Assad-controlled territory. She's a Sunni Muslim. So she became involved very early on in the opposition in a very idealistic way. She was a student, and she worked as a kind of citizen journalist. She was taken by the security forces one morning, and that's where the title of my book comes from, The Morning They Came for Us, because as she was telling me her story, she said, "The morning they came for me." And she kept saying that and repeating it over and over. And it was almost as though her life divided into before the morning they came for her and after the morning they came for her. Because once they took her to prison, she was tortured. She was raped, although she couldn't admit it.
She
couldn't say the word because, and I've come across this many, many, many times before, interviewing rape victims in conflict, especially Muslim women, it's so shameful. If they're unmarried, as she was, it means that they probably, their future husbands, won't want to touch them. Married women they don't want their husbands to ever know. It's an incredibly shameful thing for any woman, but for them, it has an entirely, another dimension. So she was forced to listen to other prisoners being raped and beaten, and horrific things. And she's a tiny little woman, and they just really, really, really brutalized her. She was eventually let go, but she was a broken person. Yeah. And I used her as a way of explaining what torture and what detention does to the psyche and how it's used to try to crush any dissent. It's a way of saying, you want to be free? Okay, this is what you're going to have to pay to be free. And are you up to it? Can you stand this? Can you withstand this kind of abuse? She's an incredibly brave young woman.
Yes. Well, let's take a very short break. I want to talk a little bit more about Nada. Talking with our guest, Janine DiGiovanni, and she's got a new book. It's called The Morning They Came for Us. And it is something that Nada said as police in Syria took her away. And she endured just unspeakable abuse and degradation. The book is subtitled Dispatches from Syria. And our guest has been covering this part of the world for many years now. She's Middle East editor of Newsweek, contributing editor of Vanity Fair. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Janine DiGiovanni about Nada, someone, a Syrian, young Syrian woman that she writes about in her new book called The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria, 1-888-477-9499. You talk about Assad's paramilitary agents. They're called the ghosts. These were the people that were torturing Nada?
Actually, she was tortured by security services. Not that it makes a difference who tortures who. It's all horrific. But the Shabia are these paramilitary. She was actually taken by conventional security services and, brought to – she was actually changed several jails in the course of her of being detained. The Shabia operated in – other areas, and I've seen paramilitaries work in other conflicts, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Africa, and they operate outside of the law, mm-hmm. naturally. Sometimes they're not combatants who are dressed in uniform, which is, of course, not that it matters much in these conflicts, against international law. Many of the women that I did interview had been abused by them. And later in 2014, I went to work for the UN's refugee agency, UNHCR, on the Syria crisis, specifically working with Syrian women who were in Turkey, Lebanon, Iraq, and Egypt, and Jordan. And I questioned them a lot about, you know, what the Shabia did, how they knew when they came. But very terrifying for civilians to live with this kind of threat over their heads. It's really unimaginable if you haven't...
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrifying. Really is. I mean, can you say that this is then a weapon of war that's being used in Syria? And you also talk about men who have been sexually violated as well.
Many. Many. Yes, I would say it's a weapon of war, definitely, in the same way that hunger, food, is being used as a weapon of war, to starve people. And, you know, Marty, all these things, I this past year I've studied, I did a degree at the Fletcher School in International Law because I really wanted to be able to put, you know, I've been reporting war crimes and human rights for 25 years, and I really wanted to be able to put it into context with, into law. It's just shocking, in a sense, that there is no, there really, when it comes to war, there is no justice. And all of the resolutions that would say, you know, you can't violate someone, you can't sexually abuse someone during wartime, well, try telling that to a, you know, a 14-year-old child soldier who's holding an RPG, or a group of paramilitaries at a checkpoint that you just happened to pass through. And what I really wanted to convey in this book was how ordinary people, people like you, me, doctors, teachers, lawyers, vegetable sellers, farmers, unemployed, artists, poets, how they suddenly found themselves face to face with monsters, and how they continued to live their lives and in some way retain dignity and try to survive, and resilience. And I think stories of war are never easy.
Sure.
But the one thing that I've seen over the years of war reporting is that human beings are incredibly resilient. And not that you want to endure a lot, but you can. And these, you know, people have come back after wartime and began to live again, and began to put back their lives. I just wish that, you know, human beings could be not so horrifically cruel to each other. And that's the worst thing about reporting war.
I just can't imagine it. But what's interesting about Nada is there are moments in when she is being held and being raped and tortured where she criticizes her jailers. I mean, there are moments when she in a sense fights back in her own kind of way.
Yes, she had this little triumph where she got them to give, you know, she was an activist after all. And so while she was being imprisoned and while they were, you know, forcing her to do horrific things, she decided that she was going to start a little campaign to make sure that they gave the prisoners their food on plates, you know, instead of throwing it on the floor or giving it to them in a bucket or whatever. And that was her little quest. And she did that. And she said, you know, I remember her telling me this story. And when she came out, she just had this smile on her face. And she said, you know, I did that. And I think I've interviewed a lot of torture victims over the years. And one thing they've always said to me is that the way they stayed alive, if not sane, was that they kept a part of themselves that no one could touch. You know, no matter what was happening to their bodies or no matter what the people were doing to them, you know, electrocuting them, burning them, whatever. They kept a part of their mind that was theirs, that was free, where only they could go. And it seems that that is something, a psychological tool that enables them to survive.
I mean, I think of that as dissociation, but I think of that as dissociation in the service of survival, which is to take your mind and put it somewhere else.
Yeah, and we all do that even sure. in everyday life, you know. So I think what I'm trying to do is people might look at this book and say, oh, but this is so far removed from my life. But what I've always felt, and I've felt this really acutely from, you know, my very first conflict, is that this could be me. You know, easily, I'm a mother. I have a 12-year-old boy. And I, you know, I always think, what would I do if war broke out in, I live in France, you know, and it's not completely unrealistic given the terrorist attacks there and the rise of right-wing fascism and everything that's happening in Europe. I'm not saying we're going to war next year, but I always think, what would I do? You know, would I take him and run away immediately? Or would I stay and would I wait until, you know, the war got too bad? And that's the question I always ask refugees. I always say, you know, what was the moment that you decided you had to leave? Because people don't want to leave. They don't want to go. They don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to leave everything behind them. And they do. You know, you have to realize that what they take with them is very minimal. It's usually just their documents, some photographs, something to eat maybe, and that's it. So the decision to leave and to start an entirely new life is so wrenching because a lot of them know they will never go home again. So you're tearing up roots.
One of the people that you talk to, and she's a supporter of President Assad, a woman called Maria, and you described to her some of what you were told by people like Nada. And you write here, there was an angelic smile on her face, and she says, do you think our president could put down his own people? She asked me incredulously, gas his own people, kill his own people? This is the work of foreign fighters. They want to change our culture. How common is that perspective?
Very. Because, I mean, essentially what she was saying, and that was way, way back in the beginning of the war, you know, we don't want radical jihadis to change, you know, and a lot of women, Damascus, it's a very modern city, very beautiful women, very, you know, stylish and chic. And a lot of them would say to me, you know, I do not want to wear, have to wear a headscarf and have to wear a chador and be completely radicalized. And there is this notion. I mean, in many ways, you know, there's this fear that they will be taken over by jihadists, by extremism. Not entirely unfounded, given that Raqqa, the capital of ISIS, is not that far away, and that ISIS have managed to, you know, create such a swathe of territory in so short a time, and to get so much support from recruits all over the world.
That's Janine DiGiovanni, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's Middle East editor for Newsweek, a contributing editor of Vanity Fair, and she has been covering the Middle East, covering conflicts in the Middle East and other parts of the world for a number of years now. She's got a new book. It's called The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria, based on numbers of interviews that she has done with Syrian people and telling her about their lives. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me also ask you about a town where Syrians, I mean, it sounds like they are really stuck in this town. It's a town called, is it Daria, D-A-R?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, I just wrote about it recently in the New York Times, yes. And an op-ed about it because I went there in, the years are 2013, I think it was, and 20. I'm right after there had been an alleged, and I say alleged because the government denies it and says it was a prisoner swap that went wrong. At any rate, there was a battle, let's put it that way, and many people were killed, and I went in. Shortly after that battle, to try to talk to witnesses about what had happened, what they saw, who the fighters were, if their homes were destroyed, to basically gather evidence. In 2016 now, 4 years down the road, Daraya is one of the besieged areas. There's 51 areas within Syria, meaning that no aid can get in, that people are living off their – they're eating things like the grass that they can boil or herbs that they can make soup out of. Haven't seen – there's some children that have been born in these areas that don't know what fruit is. Mm. They – you know, their medical care is very random because they're not getting – humanitarian. I mean, we always seem to think that in war zones, humanitarian aid comes in and out, but it doesn't. If roads are blocked and if governments won't let them in, they can't get in. So it's a really desperate place. And, you know, electricity on and off, schools, there, you know, people take it into their own hands to try to teach their children or just start schools. But these places are desperate. Mm-hmm. And anyone, you know, who wants to know more about it, just go online, because they, one thing they do have is many activists in the towns that are trying to get the word out. They don't, you know, they don't want people to forget that they're there because they feel so isolated. So they do make videos on YouTube, and I on Twitter. If you follow me on Twitter, it's at JanineDG. I post updates often on the situation of the besieged areas and just whether or not they're getting food, whether electricity, how many people were killed. What's happening in Aleppo? For instance, last week in Aleppo, the hospital Al-Quds, where I worked a lot and where I wrote a chapter in my book, was bombed. And you may think, like, why target medical workers? The only pediatrician was killed. Mm. The only pediatrician in Aleppo. A few days before that, the gynecologist was killed, the guy who delivers the babies. A few days before that, the rescue workers, the white helmets, who are these incredibly brave men who go and pull – men and women – who pull the people out of the rubble after there's been a bombing. Five of them were killed. So these attacks on healthcare facilities and rescue workers, first responders, these people aren't combatants. I mean, this is really a war against civilians. And imagine if this happened in Philadelphia.
Sure, sure.
You know, you have to put yourself into that context. And that's what I really want people to do when they read this book. I want them to think, you know, this could be me.
You make some parallels between the war in Bosnia that you covered and the civil war that's happening in Syria today, seeing some parallels in terms of the camps, the use of rape and sexual violence as a way of controlling the population. Are you also saying that the reluctance of the outside world to get involved is also similar?
Yes, very much so, except Bosnia, I think we actually had more attention. You know, Syria, the complication with Syria is that now it's become a proxy war, meaning that there are so many outside players who have interests and are so cynically involved that they're willing to let the Syrian people die to pursue their own interests. And, you know, that is on the opposition side. You have Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, to some extent the U.S. trying to vet moderate oppositions, but we haven't done a very good job of it. On the other side of the Assad side, you've got Russia, you've got Iran, you've got Hezbollah, the Shiite Party of God. You've got, you know, various players on both sides. So it's become a much bigger game. And the peace talks going on in Geneva are so remote, brokered by the UN, are so far away from what's actually happening on the ground in Syria that it has. I mean, I feel very much when you open a newspaper, you know, you don't see, you don't know what's going on. And the other reason for that is that it is so dangerous for reporters to go there. I mean, in Bosnia, I lived in Sarajevo. It was dangerous. We got shelled. We got sniped. We didn't have food. We didn't have water. We didn't have electricity. But we could report, and we could be the eyes and ears. Syria, over the past 2 years, since, you know, ISIS has become so prevalent, and since my colleagues, Jim Foley and Steve Sutloff, were beheaded by ISIS, reporters are very, very wary to go into Aleppo and Idlib and places like that.
Including you?
Yeah. I mean, I do what I can. And I want to go back to Aleppo to report on the hospitals there. But, you know, I have a son. And what I would have done not that I was expendable when I was a single woman or didn't have a child, but I don't want to be kidnapped and beheaded. The best reporter is the one who gets out alive. And in the case of Syria, increasingly, it's become, you know, a real concern for journalist rights groups like Committee to Protect Journalists. What do we do about this, you know? Do we train local journalists, but then as brave and courageous as they are, it's not the same thing? Do we just risk everything and go in and take our chances and then know, you know, you probably won't get your story on the front page? So there's a lot of factors, but we keep going.
We're almost up on a break here, but I'm looking at news from this morning. It's described as a fragile ceasefire in Aleppo. It's been extended for the next couple of days. Is that in any way give you confidence that there can be some kind of resolution for the conflict in Syria?
No, I don't trust ceasefires because I think ceasefires are things that are decided in Geneva. By the time it filters down to the parties on the ground, the cessation of hostilities that the UN brokered starting in February, it spawned the deadliest 2 to 3 weeks of the offensive in Aleppo, in which more people died, in which there was, you know, bombings of hospitals. So I don't want to be cynical, but I think that this war will end eventually. It will end. Wars end when the players on the ground are exhausted, or when there can be a negotiated settlement, or, which I really don't want to see, a partition, which is what happened in Bosnia.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see some of our listeners want to join us as well. And again, Janine DiGiovanni is our guest, and she is Middle East editor for Newsweek, also contributing editor of Vanity Fair. She's written a number of books. She's got a new one called The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria, based on a number of interviews that she did with Syrian people, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at WHYY.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Janine DiGiovanni about Syria. Let me get Mazar from, looks like, West Grove, Pennsylvania to join us. Mazar, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I have been to Syria 4 times, and Marty, I was on your talk show also about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the whole situation went down, down over there with the Arab Spring. My question is actually for your guest, because she's been there and she's, you know, getting these interviews. You know, I always want to look at the root cause analysis of a situation. When I went to Syria, you know, Syria was very peaceful. Syria accepted 1.5 million Iraqi refugees. And we visited their, you know, their homes and their camps, you know, in near Damascus. And Syria was really a peaceful country. We traveled extensively. We went to Palmyra, you know, we went to Balbosra, we went to, you know, even Lebanon around the areas. So it was a very peaceful country. I could be out at 1 o'clock in the morning and I felt very safe. We never felt threatened, our group. So then, you know, the Arab Spring starts, you know, and of course we know that what happened in Iraq, we went into Iraq, and a lot of people feel that ISIL is there because of what we did in Iraq. You know, we had Abu Ghraib prison, and we tortured the prisoners, Iraqi prisoners there. Mr. Baghdadi, who actually now runs the ISIL, you know, he himself was, in one of those camps, Camp Buka.
Mazar, let me just jump in just quickly here, only because I do want to give Janine a chance to respond to your comments. And if it sounds like you're saying that we can trace some of this stuff back to Abu Ghraib, there are roots, I guess, Janine, for much of what's going on in Syria.
Well, thank you for that, Mazar. But I do think you're confusing several different things, and so I'll try to be as simple to try to explain them. But I think when you went, first of all, you must have gone with the government. You would have had to. You have to remember that they were showing you what they wanted you to see. When you, at the time you went, if it was 4 years. It was before the war.
Yes,
it was a dictatorship. It has always been. It's been a dictatorship for the past 40 years. So yes, you saw things a peaceful. You could go out at night, and there wasn't a war raging. But in fact, underneath that, what was happening was huge dissension and people that. I mean, why people rose up is because they wanted democracy. They wanted the things that we take for granted every day. Institutions like human rights, voting, free and fair elections that aren't, you know, staged by one family and one family only, rule of law that works, not enforced detentions. So this is really what happened. And I absolutely believe you had a wonderful trip and that it was, you know, the country looked like it was functioning. But I'm sure if you had gone and talked to people that were working activists in opposition to the Assad regime, you would have gotten a different story.
Well, I'm curious, too, about whether that the Arab Spring, the uprising that we saw in Syria 5 years ago, does that still exist?
Look, you know, I get this all the time. People say to me, well, Libya was better before, before the Arab Spring, or Iraq, you know, was destroyed by the occupation. First of all, every country is different. You cannot lump them all together and say what happened in Egypt at Tahrir Square is what happened in Libya, is what happened in Tunisia. Every case, you have to take it case by case. Second, I have to say, democracy takes a long time, especially in these places that did not have institutions, what I was saying before, Libya, Syria, you know, they were dictatorships where there was not strong institutions that we take for granted. So they have to be built. And these, I'm not saying that it has to descend into chaos and civil war, but remember that the American Constitution was written, I think, 20 years after the American Revolution in 1776. Takes time to settle into democracy. And remember that some of these countries, we can't put our Western lens of what we see as Jeffersonian democracy onto them. It might be a different form. It might evolve into something else. Your question about Abu Ghraib, that's kind of getting slightly off the track here. But yes, indeed, Baghdadi and his – I wrote a piece about it in Newsweek and called it Jihad Academy. Mm. They met in prison. They festered there. And then they went to Damascus. But it really – I mean, that was a reaction to the what was happening in Iraq and importing it to Syria. Assad also encouraged it by opening up prisons and letting out many jihadis. But I think you can't confuse so many issues. Each of them has their own narrative.
Well, as you said earlier, what you fear is a divided Syria. But one wonders with the numbers of people who have left, the numbers of people who have been killed, the kind of sectarian violence, the divisions that now clearly exist within the country. How is that put back together?
I think, transitional governments are really complicated. It needs support from countries, you know, like the United States, the United Nations, the EU. It needs a lot of support to rebuild a country after it's been ripped apart. And you need to do, you know, the most basic kind of training in terms of, you know, democratic institutions. Again, getting back to that, but say freedom of expression. You know, how do you train people that have never had free expression or free and fair elections? You've got to really start from the beginning. Then you've got the whole issue of war crimes. You know, the people that did these horrible things have to be punished. And that, as we can see in Bosnia, you know, that takes a long time. Sometimes the perpetrators aren't ever caught. You know, it's the big fish, the guys, the politicians that that wage the wars that might go to The Hague. But it's not going to be the guys who actually did the raping in the villages. They'll go back and live there, and they're the women who were raped or the men who were raped will have to see them every day. So very, very complicated to put back a country that's been ripped to pieces.
Do you think Assad is a war criminal?
Yes, I do. And, I hesitated before saying that because I know it'll get a lot of, there's a lot of people who will disagree with me. But yes, I do. I do. I think he's killing his people. I think he's bombing his people. I think he's gassing his people. I think his security forces are detaining and raping and torturing people. I'm not saying the opposition, by the way, are angels, because there's been a lot of abuse on that side as well. I think in war, you know, human rights get very, you know, are very tenuous. What, you know, what happens in prisons and but I do think, yes, I do think he's a war criminal.
You talk about the other side. I mean, is it proportional? Is there any way to know that the kinds of torture and raping done by those in support of Assad, that we're seeing the same amount on the other side? Is it proportional? Do we know that?
I don't think we can. I don't think we could put that kind of quantitative. I don't think we can put figures on it yet. I mean, I just know, and again, because we have very little access to that, I just know from people I've interviewed or from cases that I've studied, you know, things happening in Aleppo. Absolutely. There are, you know, is there abuse going on with, opposition, you know, are they, yes, there was a bomb last week on the regime side of Aleppo that killed people. I mean, people are dying on both sides. People are suffering on both sides. And I'm really wary to put, to put it down to numbers or figures, because I just think that people are people. And I remember in Bosnia during the war the war in Kosovo, when Belgrade got bombed, you know, I went to see people that had been kids that had been caught in bombing. And, you know, what do they have to do with the politics of the situation? You know, when they've lost legs or arms, or when they've been so badly burned, they don't have noses or mouths anymore. You know, these are civilians, and I think that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give a voice to civilians.
Well, let me add another voice, and this is a man named Rifaf that you interviewed. And tell us who he is, and tell us what you and he talked about.
he's a regime soldier, and he took me to the front line in Homs, but the regime front line. And what I always realize when I'm with soldiers is, first of all, how young they are. You know, they're I always just think they're kids. You know, as I said, I have a 12-year-old son, and I just think in, you know, 6 or 7 years, he could be one of them, even less. And just what I realized is how, you know, their lives are stolen too. What do they want to do? They want to be with their girlfriends or their families. They want to be, you know, watching football on TV. They want to be going to university. And their lives have equally been stopped. And I think that when you group entire groups together and say, you know, the Assad, the regime are monsters, you have to look at individuals rather than the blob of it all, to use a word that's being thrown around in Washington today.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah. And not in terms of Syria, but in terms of the Obama in foreign policy administration. But anyway, I think that I try to just see him as a human being. And actually, they were trying to take out a sniper, an opposition sniper. And you realize the other thing about war is that, you know, you always see films and it's kind of exciting and it's adrenaline filled. And war is really boring. It's a lot of sitting around and waiting and trying to get the right shot. And then it's infused with moments of absolute panic and chaos and terror and fear. And I was really trying to capture what these guys and these women, you know, there's women fighters as well, go through.
Are you anti-war? Have you become anti-war?
I've always been anti-war. I've always been a pacifist. But, you know, on the other hand, increasingly, in some cases, I believe in humanitarian intervention. I believe that, you know, the strong should protect the weak. And that we waited in Bosnia till 1995, until a genocide happened in Srebrenica and 8,000 men and boys were killed. That could have been prevented very easily. Sarajevo did not have to be destroyed. It did not have to come to the point it did. We could have intervened earlier. And the same with Rwanda, where 1 million people died in a genocide. I think Syria is a slow motion genocide. I think it is a genocide, though. And I do think that we, and I don't just mean America, because I hear, you know, when people say, why should America do everything? But I think the policy that the Obama administration has taken to totally avoid it has been wrong. And the result of it has been the rise of ISIS. And this will affect us here in America. It's not just something that's happening in the Middle East, because they will The war in Syria, the rise of ISIS will destabilize the entire region. The Sunni-Shia gap will grow larger. The refugee crisis will implode even more. There will be a rise of extremism and radicalism. And this will come to America. We're not isolated. We're not. We're part of this world, and if we choose to be a global leader, then we have to act like one.
Let me see what Matthew from King of Prussia has to say. Matthew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. The one question that I had for you is: I have a colleague that is of Armenian descent, and she has family that's scattered throughout the world. She also has cousins, first cousins actually, that are in Syria. And she feeds me some of this information that she gets from them. And I was really surprised to find out that the Assad regime protects Armenians to a certain extent. Mm. And some of them were overjoyed that the Russians showed up. Yeah. And so I get a very different perspective from her. And I was just wondering if you could shed some light on that.
Please. Sure, Matthew. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
Janine, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, Matthew, when I said earlier that the regime... Traditionally, the minorities have flocked to support the regime because the regime has, you're right, the regime has protected them because they initially, and I spent a lot of time with the Christian community in Syria, they didn't know where to go, and they didn't want to in some way side with the opposition who they saw as a Sunni, and then it increasingly became radical. It was more frightening for them. And they thought they could get some kind of protection. But on the other hand, I think that I don't think we can clearly say now that it's extremists versus the regime, because you will find Shia fighters on the opposition side and you will find Sunni fighters on the Assad side. So it's kind of gone beyond this very clear sectarian cut. But yes, I'm sure that the Armenian minority were happy to see the Russians come, but then they were probably not sitting in Aleppo under Russian bombs. And as we know, the Russians seem to target more hospitals, more schools, more areas where the white helmets were digging out bodies than they did of combatants. I've been under Russian bombardment in Chechnya. It is not fun. There is not a big regard for for civilians. They want to obliterate. And I think, you know, the thought was that they would come in and they would wipe out ISIS, but in fact, they took out a lot of civilians as well.
Matthew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. About a minute, Janine, before we have to say goodbye to you. In the epilogue of your book, you write how different my life would have been if I had never seen a mass grave or a truck with bodies all dead, piled one on top of the other. And you go on from there. Regrets about what you have done with your life?
No, never. I have no regrets of anything. I just think that's a kind of useless emotion because we do what we do. And I feel very honored and very privileged that I've been able to do this work and that people have let me into their lives. And I feel that, you know, I don't know if I've ever affected policy, but I'm certainly going to try. And if I can just enlighten people a little bit and make them think how lucky they are to have the lives that they do, to have electricity, to have water, to have freedom, to have democracy, to be able to vote, as confusing as the elections are now in America, you know, just to feel that we are fortunate and to be grateful, then I've done my job.
Well, thank you for doing your job, and thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And again, Janine DiGiovanni, our guest, and she's got a new book. It's called The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. And she is a Middle East editor for Newsweek, contributing editor of Vanity Fair. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Well, from real war to virtual war in the next hour of Radio Times. Homefront: The Revolution. It's a new video game. It's set in a future Philadelphia that's being occupied by a united Korea, the world's superpower. I'll be talking with the director, and then we'll be talking about the world of video games. Hope you can join us.
The Academy of Vocal Arts supports WHYY. AVA's award-winning resident artists perform in fully staged productions of the composer's only comedy, Gianni Schicchi, and the lurid drama of Il Tabarro. Saturday night at Central Buck South High School in Warrington, Christopher Makatsouris leads the AVA Opera Orchestra in Il Tabarro, and Richard Raub conducts Gianni Schicchi. 215-735-1685 or avaopera.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Yo, Philadelphians, what do you think our fair city would look like in the year 2029 if a united Korea was the world's global superpower and decided to occupy the city? Well, imagine no more. A new video game depicts just this scenario, and it's called Homefront: The Revolution. We'll talk with the game's director, Hasit Zala, to find out what it was like to create this nightmarish future. Then we'll talk about some of the more interesting developments happening in the world of video games with Patrick Klepek of Kotaku and Jake Muncy of Wired. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.